previously on Popping Collars.
Like, I showed up for opening chapel. We had our first chapel for just faculty yesterday. And yesterday on Tuesday. And I showed up, and the other chaplain said, okay, so our plan during chapel is to have you, Betsy, on a rotating platform, like during the, you know, whatever. And it was, you know, we were laughing about it, but it's like, you know, it just kind
I'm sure this is something that can come up when we're looking on doing a show at some point about how religion is horrible with body issues.
Terrible. Terrible.
Christianity tends to be really bad with bodies.
It takes a whole day to travel to our convention, so shut up.
In here.
So let's talk a little bit about bodies. In the news, past couple of weeks, big scandal, right? We had the a hack of, I think it was specifically Apple. It was like the Apple iCloud or something like that. But a bunch of celebrities had photos that they had taken for private use, kind of leaked on the internet through various websites, and all of a sudden started showing up on Twitter. That's how I found it. I think Jennifer Lawrence was
found it. Yeah, sure, exactly. It was.
I just logged into Google.
Oh my God, Jennifer Lawrence, how did this window come up? Do. I don't even know.
Greg's hashtag was naked Jennifer Lawrence. That's how it was.
I'm already turning red. I'm already turning red on this topic. Jennifer Lawrence starts trending as a trending topic. I click on it, and all of a sudden, I'm horrified at the pictures.
Horrified? That's rude.
Horrified because I feel like I've been invited into this world that I wasn't invited into. Like, I felt like a voyeur all of a sudden, and that wasn't my intent as a Twitter user. I felt like I was somehow part of this exploitative machine that was kind of going on. So that got me thinking. That got us thinking as a group, I think, about reactions to bodies, because I think you're right, Betsy. Why was my reaction to Jennifer Lawrence's pictures this sense of, well, that girl needs to put on some clothes? Like, what is that saying about me? What is that saying about kind of our religious culture, I think, that that does value covering up, modesty, covering your body at all costs, it seems like, anyway. I kind of throw this out there. Let's kind of think about the celebrity issue first. So obviously we can agree this is exploitative, right? What happened to these women? What happened to the few men, although the men don't seem to be exploited as much as the women in this case?
I think it's exploitative. I think anytime you hack into someone's personal information or accounts, it's exploitative by nature anyway, regardless of the subject matter. It's an invasion of privacy, and usually for someone else's benefit. So, I think the whole idea of it is the problem. But to the point, which is about body shaming, you know, that subject is so big and broad. And so many ways that we shame each other and our bodies. It's not just about nudity, but it certainly is in this case. You know, what is our theology of the human body and of creation, even if we feel like we can't hold the tension of seeing what I would imagine is a beautiful naked body by our standards anyway, or even a non-beautiful naked body. You know, what is our theology of creation if we insist that that be covered up and we get grossed out by it or disgusted by it?
So the argument that you heard a lot of with regards to these women was around issues of responsibility. And it was, well, you know, these women shouldn't have taken these pictures to begin with. It's their fault. Even though it's their accounts being hacked, and information that they considered private being brought public, and not by them, somehow it's these women's fault. These women, it's their fault for these pictures being leaked. That seems like a generational argument, but I saw it as a conservative argument coming from kind of a conservative Christian audience.
Well, and it was everywhere. There was a big article in People magazine basically saying how to avoid naked pictures of yourself being published. Don't take any naked pictures of yourself, as if that's the sin, is these women taking photographs of themselves, it not the stealing of their private property. So it's all over. And it's so interesting to me that, you know, everybody, but there are lots of people who wanted to see Jennifer Lawrence naked, and then they did. And then they shame her and harass her. I mean, she can't win. The celebrities can't win. So it's true that there's a value in our culture on modesty, but not really, because we also like it when, you know, the Victoria's Secret catalog comes, or, you know, whatever it is. We're of two minds about it.
I found a great article on column that's on the online on The Guardian under the headline of "The Great 2014 Celebrity Nude Photos Leak is Only the Beginning." There will always be another leak because there's always curiosity in the bodies of naked celebrity women. There's always danger in being an other. And like the first paragraph, I want to read this, is "Privacy is a privilege, is rarely enjoyed by women or transgender men and women, queer people or people of color. When you are an other, you are always in danger of having your body or some other intimate part of yourself exposed in one way or another. A stranger reaches out and touches a pregnant woman's belly. A man walking down the street offers an opinion on a woman's appearance or implores her to smile. A group of teenagers driving by as a person of color walks on the sidewalk shout racial slurs, interrupting their quiet." It's written by Roxane Gay. And it's really interesting, and it says some of the same things that you all were saying. You know, it goes without saying, she writes, "Many nude photos of men were also being released, but they were largely free to bear their bodies as they choose without repercussion, unless, in the case of a couple of people, they happened to be pictured with a young woman, and so then were pictured kind of collateral damage to really seeing the other part." But I find that so interesting, you know, that even, you know, thinking back to the Marilyn Monroe pictures in Playboy and Vanessa Williams as Miss America, which we just had the Miss America pageant. I mean, that there's always this interest in kind of what you can't see, what you're not supposed to see. And so we want to see. And what's that rubbernecking about? Why are there so few boundaries in terms of kind of, oh, I think that might be a transgender person. I wonder what parts they have. You know, that's the question that people want to know.
Well, it's, obviously, there's something about objectification here, right? Because the biggest selling issue of Sports Illustrated is the swimsuit issue, bar none. That's like their top seller for the year, like hands down. And for the most part, these aren't even real pictures. These are pictures that are doctored beyond, you know, human anatomy, right? What is it that is enticing, I guess? Is it, and I like this article, this kind of search for the other, because is it that, or is it a search for something that people consider taboo or unreachable or unattainable? We need to kind of posterize it.
Well, and the article ends with just saying, you know, it's just another reminder that the rules are different for girls, that the rules are different for women, and at least in the public sphere, that you can't have a picture be in that way without there being some kind of consequence, which is sad.
So I heard the responsibility argument as a generational argument, and maybe it was because I was only hearing it from a few sources, but it felt to me that it was these women being blamed, yes, but it was also young people being blamed for how they use the technology that they're given. So I heard a lot of, well, you know, I would have never, you know, taken nude pictures of myself when I was their age or something like that. It was all this kind of blaming young people for not taking responsibility for their actions the way that older generations would. And that's kind of how I heard that argument framed.
You know, as you're talking, Greg, it strikes me that I wonder if it's about projected shame. Like there's this sense in a previous generation, you know, mine included. I was born in 68. There's a level of that going on, but certainly prior to me, there was this sense of shame about body enough that my mom didn't even know how to talk to me about my period when that came. You know, it was really quite an funny conversation that I won't go into, but it strikes me that the conversation might be more like, why aren't you as ashamed as I am? You know, like you should be ashamed because I'm ashamed.
Yeah.
So this projection of shame onto a generation that really isn't interested in it, maybe, and doesn't quite understand it. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Go ahead, Liz.
Oh, I was just wondering, did any of the celebrities release statements about their reactions to having their photos stolen?
So that's actually an interesting note. There were a few that said it wasn't me. I think that was I don't want to start dragging people's names down because I can't corroborate it, but there was at least one celebrity I know that said, oh, that's not my body. There were people like Jennifer Lawrence who just flat out said, that's me. Those are my pictures. And
yeah, they've said that, you know, it's a flagrant violation of privacy. The authorities have been contacted and will prosecute anyone who posts the stolen photos.
Right. And then there was one that framed it within the confines of her marriage, that it was these were pictures that I was sharing with my husband, and she tried to set it up as this isn't kind of something salacious. This is something that's sort of within kind of how we understand traditional married relationships, you know, that kind of thing.
And then Kirsten Dunst tweeted, thank you, iCloud. And then there was a picture of pizza and then something that looks like a pile of dog poo with a happy face on it. So emoji-con, I don't know, but not happy.
I get the sense that there is, because, you know, when you said that, Michelle, about your conversation with your parents, and maybe this is something that I can relate to too. I don't think I ever had a conversation with my parents about my body or about my body, about sexuality, about anything like that. And, you know, I grew up in a more conservative, rural Christian tradition. And that certainly wasn't part of anything that we were told. If anything, we were told that any desires that kind of existed in our body should immediately kind of be shoved back, shoved down, shoved away, however you want to say it. And it all went back to some scripture, right, about what Paul, like taming the body, that kind of language. And it makes me wonder if that, I mean, that was kind of a holdover kind of mentality, but I wonder if our generation did grow up kind of inheriting the body issues of our parents a little bit.
Well, I didn't talk about it with my parents, but they kept sending me to all these evening things at other churches in the area where we would talk about it. So I recall Pictionary in the Methodist church basement trying to draw a fallopian tube, you know, and have people guess that that's what they were. And it was almost like it was all of those kind of, you know, demystifying and, you know, just being able to say the stuff.
Yeah.
That there were so many exercises kind of around that part just to get people talking. You know, when I went to sex camp in high school, which was it's basically the spirituality of sexuality. And so there's a nurse on staff and multi-generational staff. And I don't think they do it anymore in the Diocese of Alabama, but it was a great thing, I think, as a young person to go to. And then I was on staff for it later for a younger generation of kids. But I don't recall having a lot of conversation with my parents, but it was something that was kind of discussed in a bigger sense around. But yeah, my parents kept sending me to church to talk about it.
go to church to talk about sexuality.
Go to church to talk about it. You know.
What about you, Liz? Are you comfortable coming in on this conversation?
Sure. Yeah, I had a pretty open dialogue about sex and, well, mostly about bodies with my parents, especially with my mom, about, like, you know, your changing body, that type of thing. That never felt shameful or uncomfortable. A lot of the body shame that I picked up, that I really remember really strongly, came from peers and came with body image, size, stuff like that. It didn't have as much to do with sex or sexuality as it did just kind of like how you looked in comparison to other girls. And that was like a pretty profoundly disturbing realization. I mean, I remember in middle school thinking for the first time ever that maybe my body wasn't perfect or something, or as good as it could be. Or, I mean, I remember thinking about it for the first time and how destructive that felt. And a lot, I mean, boy, I know the boys experienced that too, but that was really a peer thing, which of course then is reflected in our whole culture. But I'm really interested. I tried to imagine what would happen if, like, somehow the whole world saw me in that way, the poor, you know, those celebrities did, and how I would feel ashamed and super embarrassed and violated. And then I started thinking back about, you know, Genesis, and before the fall, quote the fall, when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, they looked at each other and were naked and not ashamed. Like, that's actually the biblical language, that they stood before each other naked and felt no shame. And that's really amazing to me. If we want to restore our image as being made, you know, in the likeness of God, our shame about our bodies certainly has something to do with that.
It has something to do with claiming our humanity, I feel like, a little bit. Were you about to say something, Michelle?
No, I was just nodding along with Liz, because that's really the shame that I picked up, too, was more around body image. I grew up, I've never known my body to be considered thin or even average. I've always carried weight, and have, you know, from an early age, my parents were talking to me about dieting. So that's the shame that I picked up too. And it led into, you know, the sexualization of my body, because there was a lack of an idea that I could be attractive, that I could be sexual, because I wasn't appropriate. My body wasn't appropriate for it. So that's too where I picked it up at a very early age, that, and it didn't happen until I was an adult, where I remember the first time I went to in Oregon, where most people were, you know, so crunchy up there, that we all go to hot springs. And I was scared to go into the hot springs without a suit on. But when I did, it was the most natural thing I could have done. As a matter of fact, when I tried to do it with a bathing suit on, I felt stupid. That I was just nodding along with Liz that I understand that piece. That's how it picked up for me.
Genesis, Betsy. You've got a Genesis take on this, right?
I do. We've just been, I mean, it's the beginning of the school year, so I've been talking all about Genesis and the two creation stories with my sophomores, and it's such a difference between the two stories.
Wait, there are two creation stories?
Wait, hold on.
You're blowing my mind, Betsy.
Hold on, I'm blowing your mind. There might even be multiple sources in the Bible. I'm just going to throw it out there. It might not all be Moses in the first five books. Boom! That just happened. So, no, so we're... So, and well, the fun thing is for some of them, it was, what? What are you talking about? They kept trying to bring up Adam and Eve the whole day. We were just talking about the first story. I hadn't even assigned the other chapters yet. I'm like, nope, we're not talking about that. So, you know, first story, it's creating humankind made in the image of God, Imago Dei. and men and women created together. So you get this kind of God that's big enough to hold all gender, to hold all appearance, to hold all race. And we start painting ourselves into a corner in story two, where it's very, you know, the order is not as liturgical. It's, oh, well, we're going to create a couple of things. So this man, who's the most important thing, is here first. And important so much that God is so concerned that this man is lonely. I posted a little photo on our class site of like a little 50s Bible illustration. It's like Adam lonely, naked, like with, deer. You can't see anything because there's a deer next to him that he's petting. And he's very lonely. And all he really wants is a companion. And he wants some buddies. So the animal buddies aren't enough. And so then he goes to sleep. And then the woman is made from the rib. And the kids were totally fascinated by the fact that women have an extra rib than men do. Sure. But it's that moment of, you know, some of the classes focused a little on kind of how Eve gets tagged in the whole thing. But what they were interested in as to why the clothes, you know, why is the nudity part, how does that play into, you know, someone was like, well, maybe it's like Southern California and the weather's totally perfect in the Garden of Eden and there are no bugs and there are no thorns. You know, there's no need for clothes. Because when we think about why do we wear clothes to protect, right? Do we wear clothes to cover? Do we wear, you know, why do we wear clothes? Why do we wear clothes that signify who we are and what we do and all of that stuff? But where is, why the putting on of clothes for these people who wrote this story about their making sense of the world? What do the clothes mean?
Well, it's got to be about sex, right? Because Adam, he's got all of his animals around him and he looks at them. There's something missing. You know what I mean?
These aren't sexually compatible.
No, exactly. So that's how I've always taken it. And that when they sin and sort of see themselves in all that sin, that they then feel ashamed. But it's got to be about sex.
But that knowledge of good and evil, then is nudity evil? And now I can see it, and I need to cover it. You know, it's by implication that the nudity is a part of now what I can see that I couldn't see before.
Well, you know, but if you look at indigenous cultures even today, they don't wear too many clothes at all. I mean, women don't wear cover on their on their breasts. They don't. There's nothing there. And I would think that, and quite often they don't wear anything on their bottom end either. So I don't, you know, I don't know if it's about.
Well, that's been used against them in terms of being civilized.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, your National Geographic kind of, you know, whatever.
So what we're talking about is civilization then.
Right.
And not necessarily God.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about we're always talking, it's all people.
Yeah. On top. I remember I was preaching a sermon a while back, and I want to say it was like Trinity Sunday or something like that, and I used 2001 as my kind of example, and I think I was using the Genesis, it was the creation story. Yeah, it was the Genesis creation story was the thing. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, the image from 2001 is really, that's humanity, because you're shown these kind of primitive, like ape people who are kind of destroying each other with bones, you know, at the beginning of the movie. And then at the end of the movie, you're shown the birth of this, galaxy child, this cosmic being is created. And it's pretty obvious to me that what Kubrick is saying is that we're both of these things. We're this crazy primate, you know, trying to kill each other because we don't know any better. And we're also this being, like, created by God, this amazing kind of creation that exists in the cosmos beyond the infinite. And I feel like not being ashamed is recognizing that we are that creation of God, and being ashamed is recognizing that we are these primate beings that exist on the planet Earth, you know.
Well, then so many of the
trying to cover each other up.
So many of the consequences then given to Adam and Eve afterwards involve the body. They involve the body of the snake. They involve the man having to work in the body. They involve the woman in childbirth. And though she still desires her husband, childbirth is going to suck. And so there's just so much kind of in the body, because that's all we have. This is what we have. This is what cosmic things I've been lent this time. And so that's, you know, aside from being removed, my body being removed and out of the garden, and you can't be here anymore. You know, that so much of it is that body focus. And where I want to go, especially in working with teenagers, is really talking about that stewardship of creation piece. That dominion that we all are given, the dominion to respect one another's bodies, to not put one another down, to not violate the boundaries that people are giving us in terms of how we are together, either in a relationship or, you know, in social media or whatever it's going to be, that you are a steward not only of the little birds and the trees and the stuff, but all of creation, all of humanity, all of those bodies, you know, to go in that direction as opposed to kind of, you know, talking about skirt lengths all the time. I'm sick of it. The iPhone test, right, you know, it can't be, this is the distance between your knee and the bottom of the skirt. And if it's not, you gotta go change clothes.
There you
go. And it's the girls, because the boys, the dress code is easy.
It's the girls,
they wear shorts or pants. Button and collared shirts, ties, and that's it. And that's, you know, your zone. The women, and people have a hard time enforcing them. Sorry, it's uncomfortable.
We had a big dress code issue in my high school that maybe happened like my junior or senior year. I went to a Catholic high school, a Jesuit high school that was pretty progressive and like talked a lot about theology. And one year, like the dress code thing just blew up. And I remember as students, they separated the boys and the girls, and a female teacher told us about why we needed to be careful with our dress code. And I remember bra straps being the biggest issue, visible bra straps. And the teacher said that we were distracting other male teachers, not male students, male teachers. Can you imagine? Talk about
it.
Oh, talk about shame. And again, it was one of those like milestone moments in my life. The first time it occurred to me that like that, oh gosh, it was horrible.
It's the police tune. Don't stand so close to me, you little.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That's right, Ab. Watch out, Liz Easton. Cover up those bra straps.
So
where's the collar now? Cover those bra straps.
You weren't reading Lolita at the time, right? You were.
You were living Lolita.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah, I think that's lovely, Betsy. The stewardship image, the stewardship of the body and stuff. You know, I'm reminded of something that Dan Savage, actually, of all people, who I actually love his podcast, even though he's got a whole page on his website devoted to like how terrible my job is as a youth mm-hmm. leader for a church. But I remember him saying something about, you know, and this kind of ties back to the celebrity thing, but it's about how kids use bodies and especially pictures to shame each other. And this idea of putting a camera in the hands of teenagers and giving them the ability to alter people and put captions on people's faces and stuff like that. It's the worst part of the technology for young people who haven't really formed that ability to recognize concretely the full consequences of their actions, who in the moment want to say something terrible about Gene or whoever it is that's pissing them off in the moment, and this is their outlet to do it, and they have the technology to do it immediately in front of everyone else. It's the carry, right? Except it's electronic carry times 10. And he always kind of bemoans that as something that we kind of take for granted in the teenage world right now.
There's a really good movie I saw over sometime last week called Disconnect, and it's about internet and media and all these different ways that we have of connecting and how it's used badly. One of the there's like three stories in it. One of the stories is about someone hacking and doing identity theft. But the big, more profound story is when these kids get another kid to, they fake an identity on Facebook. They fake an identity of a little girl, or not a little girl, excuse me, like early teenage girl, like 13, 14. And, saying to this kid who's the same age, you know, I really like you and I like the music that you just posted. And so starting to get him to trust her. Meanwhile, there's these two other boys that are in his class. And eventually they get him to post a picture of himself. And then they blast it around the school. And the kid, he attempts suicide because of it. And it's the fallout from the rest of the movie is the fallout from that incident. And the fact that they really didn't know what they were doing when they did that. They didn't understand the consequences. They didn't see what might happen by getting him to shame himself in that way. And not that it was real, it's really about shaming him because he took the picture of himself for this girl. And in that instance, you know, in that intimate moment, there's no shame. Like he didn't feel ashamed in doing that because he trusted who he thought was this, mm-hmm. this girl. But when it's blasted across and used for a different purpose, specifically to shame, then he can't handle the level of shame that he's faced with. And he tries to commit suicide. It's really an amazing movie. It's kind of depressing as hell. But
yeah. Doesn't sound like that upbeat comedy.
No.
It stars Jason Bateman.
Like a really Ghostbusters double feature.
Right, it does. It does. Well, and I think too, like having a child who's 7 years old and is still at the age when she can get out of the shower and like run in with her towel on to where her dad is sitting in the office and go, "Wah!" and like open the towel up. Totally flash up and then run back in the other room. And I look at her sometimes and I'm like, when will this change? When is the moment going to happen? There's occasional times that she's like, she gripped her belly. Like it happened. Like she was like five. I don't even think she knew what she was talking about. She's like, "I'm fat." And I'm like, "What? You know, what are you even talking about? How do you even, we don't even use that word, you know?" And thinking about how, you know, my parents, we never had a lot of conversations about bodies, but, and not like they're exhibitionists or anything, but, you know, they don't have a lot of qualms about changing clothes in front of people. I mean, they don't. And there was a story that came out the other day about a mom saying, you know, I'm not worried that I change clothes and my young sons see me do this, you know, until it's embarrassing for them. It's not embarrassing for me, you know, because it's, I'm showing something to them that we can be comfortable with who they are, and I'm comfortable with who I am. And you know, that when your kids are little and that you take a bath with them or you shower with them, you know, that there's, you know, these different things, and that Ruby asks questions all the time about, you know, so how, where did I come out of your belly? Can I see the scar, you know, from the C-section and those sorts of things about the bodies and stuff. But, you know, I'm knowing, you know, we're not in taking pictures of the thigh gap and posting them anywhere. You know, we're hopefully a long way away from that kind of media body shaming stuff. But that it starts with little things. You know, the kid that makes a comment about something, you know, the fork she uses to eat her fruit with, and she's decimated, you know, "Oh no." And, you know, but that at the moment we're still free and fun with our bodies. In the house, not running around everywhere, but in the house. But I know it will change. And how am I going to navigate that? as her mom.
And both of those examples, Michelle, yours, and Betsy, yours about Ruby, they all come back to that first paragraph. It all keeps coming back to what you read at the open, Betsy, is this idea of othering. It's trying to figure out what the other is so that we can shame it, so that we can kind of scapegoat it and put all of our, you know, nasty kind of self-loathing onto somebody else, is what a lot of that sounds like.
How can faith be a more active and positive presence in this conversation?
Well, I think a lot of it is what you're talking with your students about, is about being stewards of creation, our created bodies, our created beings, and being respecting the dignity of every person, including your classmates. And that is just like what you guys were just talking about. It's the consequence stuff that's so hard for kids to understand. They know that their feelings are intense and big, but it's hard for them to understand that it is for other people too. But to me, that's a huge message that the church can give them. I mean, it's in our baptismal covenant. Both, you know, all of this stuff really is in there, that to be a faithful Christian means respecting the dignity of other people and, you know, seeking and serving justice in our communities.
Yeah, I don't know much about scripture, but I know a lot about Star Wars. And at one point, Yoda says to Luke, while he's being trained on Dagobah, he says, luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. And it kind of pinches like Luke's skin as he says that last line. And I always think to myself, you know, it's a great Yoda quote. He probably should have stopped at the first half. Luminous beings are we, just in sentence right there. Because honestly, like, it's this whole, like, you know, if we weren't trapped in this vessels, like, we would just be the greatest things ever, right? But no, these are the vessels. These are the vessels that we've been given by God to kind of navigate the world. And a lot of these vessels are going to be different for different people. And it doesn't make them any less luminous. That's the thing. And I think that's the piece that I try to encourage with my kids, when we go through our lessons, it's not about trying to figure out what's wrong with everybody else. It's about claiming who you are, claiming who everyone else is, and recognizing the beauty of God in all of us as a community. I think that
the organic part, the messy part, is where the connection actually is. And it's why I think Fight Club is such a theological statement. Honestly, it's, you know, okay, they're pounding each other senseless, but Tyler Durden says we are the all dancing, all singing crap of the world. We are a compost heap. And he's exactly right. That's exactly what we are. And I feel like that's exactly what we should be celebrating. We're this messy creation. We were created to be messy creation. We were created as organic beings that are just going to become food for worms. And there's this beauty in that. It's like God's inherent sustainability in creation. You know, this matter becomes something that is fed to other matters. And maybe it's not, you know, to the extent of soy and green or something like that, but it is, or even that part in Cloud Atlas, right, where they're killing off the clones to feed the new clones. But there is something about that's creation. That's exactly what it is. And I think that makes us feel even more precious, or makes me feel even more intensely the preciousness of life that rises up, you know, to inhabit a collection of this organic matter long enough to hopefully appreciate the hell out of the rest of the organic matter, and God infused in that. Mm-hmm. I would love to do a theological reflection on Fight Club, but no one can get past the pounding of each other's faces.
Well, and it's, you know, and I totally agree. And it's also that element of, I'll blow your minds again. You know, large parts of the creation narrative are cribbed and lifted from the Babylonians. I'm sorry, it's true.
Minds continue to be blown. Delivered straight from
such
God.
A strong indicator. So no, but that element in the Babylonian piece that isn't isn't as explicit in the biblical creation. When Tiamat is killed and creation comes out of her body, you know, that her part of her is the heavens, part of her is the earth, and that literal giving of the body. And this is not the only creation narrative where the main, one of the main creators dies, and from them, the physical creation is created. And I find that just concrete connection just rings so true in what we're talking about. So.
Well, it's the Christ narrative too. I mean, it's the resurrection narrative. It's Christ died to give new life. So the death of Jesus on the cross gives us life. That's what we say. Mm-hmm. And it harkens back then to exactly that creation story, I think, that out of death comes life.
Mm-hmm.
I was confused not long ago. I thought, what will I do if my life isn't slow and relaxed? And it rushes like hurricanes blow. I'm frightened. But then I met you and it all became clear. The doubt turned to fame and the fame turned to fear. What will they do when I'm no longer here? They'll miss me. You've got the body and I've got the brains. You've got the body and I've got the brains. You've got the body and I've got the brains. You've got the body and I've got the brains.
Can't leave me here, I need you by my side. Said that you love me, I know when you lie. You can't breathe in space.
That's 'cause nobody's tried. Please let me go. Nothing is wrong, that's what I always say. Nothing but death is America's way. Nothing but nothing but nothing today. Can't stop me.
You can't go out there, you'll never come back. You can't make up for the cells that you lack. You know that love isn't made up of facts.
Will be distracting. Like, I wasn't excited about it because they picked ugly American actors to be. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm not shaming any American actor.
So it's time for our Go In Pieces segment, where we get to talk about something going on in our ministries, in our lives, in our pop culture worlds, to promote at the end of the show. We'll start with you, Liz. Do you have a piece to share with us?
Sure. I just got back from an epic 7-day journey through North and Central Nebraska. In the Diocese of Nebraska where I work, we have 53 parishes that are spread out over the whole state of Nebraska. And every church gets at least one visit from the bishop every year, and usually also one from the canon of the ordinary. And sometimes we do that by taking a big week-long road trip where we hit a bunch of them at the same time, and it's a blast. And that was great fun, beautiful country. We were out in the sand hills of Nebraska, which are just stunning. And one of the things that we did on our journey was we led a retreat based on a book called The Restoration Project by Christopher Martin. Mm-hmm. He's a priest in California who has come up with sort of over a lot of time of thinking about it, and his experience in parish ministry has sort of distilled Benedictine spirituality into basic ways of developing and deepening your relationship with Jesus through everyday practices. And he really encourages the formation of these small discipleship groups that meet about maybe twice a month to talk about the disciplines of Christian discipleship and hold each other accountable for, you know, journeying together through that process. So that was great fun. I've been working with that book for a few years now, and I'm in a small discipleship group myself, so it was great to share that with people. And one of the things we did a totally seminary-style art project, like a craft. And one of the things that we did was we asked them, the folks on the retreat, to create a collage or an image or a picture or something that depicts what God thinks of them. So what do I look like to God? And the idea of the restoration project is like a painting that needs to be restored. Our souls also can use restoration to more closely show the image of God, how we were made. So anyway, these just delightful people all over, you know, these small communities in Nebraska would make these collages, and they had never done it that in a long time, and told stories about how they think God thinks of them. It was really fun and
so sweet.
Yeah.
That's cool. Can I rip that off?
Totally.
Oh, I love it. Because I've done the reverse. I've had the kids find Google image pictures of what God looks like to them.
Right.
Yeah,
it was fun. And I totally recommend the book, The Restoration Project by Christopher Martin. It's great.
Nice.
Betsy, do you have a piece to share?
Well, this past week on Friday, I preached for the first time here at the school. Ever. No, here at school with, you know, all, you know, 460 students and 100 faculty people and all that kind of stuff. So it's always a little nerve wracking, you know, we joked about it, but it was, you know, you don't have a lot of time and you kind of, you know, you're trying to define yourself in the community and all that kind of stuff. So I just went for it and did some name dropping of the new show Jersey Bell on Bravo, because it was the reading from a couple of Sundays ago, when it's basically like, you know, how to handle conflict in your community. And so it was like, go and speak privately and then bring two people with you if that doesn't work, and then get the leadership involved and, you know, you can solve this problem. And so it just struck me as, you know, I've been spending a lot of time here with the handbooks of the school and trying to help my freshman advisees figure stuff out. And so it felt like it could have come out of that. And how do those words speak to us dealing with conflict as a community? And I had been reflective of how I was raised to deal or not deal with conflict based off of where some of, you know, who I am and how I like to socialize with people, but also where I'm from. And I'm from the tiny kingdom featured in Jersey Bell from Mountain Brook in Alabama. And so when I watched the show, everyone down there was very concernicus about the show because it was going to expose the secrets of the community, was what it says in the credits. And I didn't really find too much of that. And there are occasional times that the woman from New Jersey who's married to a guy from down there is intentionally provocative. But what I found so refreshing is that she told it like it is. And show the women on this show wouldn't be caught dead flipping tables in any public area like Jersey Housewives or something. That's just not how you roll. It's a lot of knowing glances, veiled conversation, but she's just very direct. And so I watched her be so direct and I was like, oh, wow, that I haven't seen that often. And so it gave me this new insight into how I deal with conflict. And so I brought that to the table and, you know, outed myself as a person with questionable television tastes and which was received well in the community. And that some people said, you know, yeah, I feel like, you know, maybe our sports team has gotten to a point where the kids want to get along more than they want to actually have the hard conversation. They want to avoid talking about what we need to talk about or whatever it is. So conflict avoidance. Thank you, Bravo TV, for helping me.
Bravo TV comes through again.
It does. Thank,
the church is everywhere.
Thank you, Andy Cohen.
Michelle, do you have a piece to share?
For the last year I've been doing two jobs for the diocese. A little bit more than that, doing the director of Whitaker Institute, which is formation for the diocese, as well as my ministry developer gig. And so there's that lesson of self-care. But recently that's shifted because we hired the director, a new director again. So for the past month, I've been on this string of vacation, retreat, vacation kind of pattern, which has been really renewing for me. But I came out of that. The last piece was this week on Beaver Island, which is this small island in the middle of Lake Michigan. And what you can only get there by ferry, and everything closes at 6 o'clock, like everything. I came off of that island back onto the mainland in Michigan and went into this weekend of a whirlwind weekend where I had multiple responsibilities all over the diocese. So a couple of things are really going on, one of which is that we finally brought to fruition the search for a new curriculum for our deacons as well as our total ministry teams. And we're using the Iona Initiative curriculum out of the Diocese of Texas, which is really a great curriculum. I sat in on the first session of the Bible, and it completely debunks they start with the history. They don't start with Genesis. I'm like, yes.
So smart.
And it's a good curriculum. I'm really happy that we chose it. And so I got to watch that being launched, which was really fulfilling for the work that I did over the last year and the kind of pushing that I did to get that in place. So that felt good. And then the next morning, on Sunday morning, I got up and preached at Nativity, which is a congregation who used to be a mission at this really Christ Church Cranbrook, which is a cardinal parish in our diocese. And Nativity was a mission of them in the 1950s or 60s, I think. And it's this little community now who have gone through such a decimation of membership that they're now needing to discern their way forward. They can't afford a full-time priest. It's the typical kind of, storyline that we hear for smaller congregations now. So as the ministry developer, I get called in to help them discern for a year of how they want to move forward. So I got to preach the forgiveness piece with them, which was really quite powerful because a couple in that congregation had just lost their adult daughter to a car crash, and it was this it was really just a powerful service and quite a sweet group of people. And then later in the day I got to go along to my Lexarandi group, which is this small ancient future church emergent kind of worship experience at Christ Church Cranbrook. We take pop songs and we have these amazing musicians that, can pull off this pop song at a moment's notice. They just download, they have some kind of app where they download the sheet music. And so they're playing Oasis tunes and, Alanis Morissette and all kinds of stuff. And they're good, really good. And so we put together the service for this Lexarandi group. And the format is, we chat and have drinks, and then we move into the pop song / readings part. And then we have dinner. We have a really good dinner usually that's cooked for us. And move into the chapel where we have this amazing Eucharist, candlelit Eucharist that's got cantor. And so I get to work on my own chanting chops. But the kick, the really fun part about it was we did this mashup at the end of Amazing Grace and Peaceful, Easy Feeling by the Eagles. Yeah. And so you take Peaceful, Easy Feeling and you take the verses to Amazing Grace and you use the verses in the tune of Peaceful, Easy Feeling, and then you sing the chorus of Peaceful, Easy Feeling. And it worked so well, and it went so beautifully that it was kick ass. It was really amazing. We were having a great time, just clapping along after having this big, heavy conversation about forgiveness, and then we do this amazing grace, peaceful, easy kind of feeling. It was gorgeous. So it was really quite renewing, and it gave me a lot of energy to refocus back into my ministry again after a month of trying to figure out what the hell's next. So it's good.
Very cool. Very cool. I have taken the role of baby whisperer on very seriously.
That's a TNT show, right?
The baby whisperer. and as a matter of fact, it's come up for me again. The baby is up and ready to go back down to sleep again. So I'm going to have to take off. But, it's been it's been a joy having the stresses, I think, that come with having the second child, because it reminds you of just how important it is to balance all of this stuff that we do with the people that are really important in our personal lives. And that's become crystal clear to me, with, you know, how hard it is, sometimes to make sure that I'm here and present and, responsible to my children and to my wife, and yet responsible to the ministries that I'm in charge of, at the same time. I think the stress has sort of made that crystallized for me. And so, it was a good reminder to have. And so I'll be rocking a kid until 3 o'clock in the morning, I imagine. But it's the best kind of lack of sleep I think you can get. So.
Aww.
And with that, yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I'll leave us on a sappy ending.
Father of the year.
With that. This has been another episode of Poppin' Cowboys.
Wait.